Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Dr. Stephen Murgatroyd in this episode. Stephen has a history of innovation, including time with both the Open University and Athabasca University, and has for many years been an international consultant whose work continues to influence policy and practice at the highest levels. Well, I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Murgatroyd, Chief Executive of the Collaborative Media Group Incorporated, with a vast international and publication history. So Stephen has a variety of publication and educational experience that includes time as an academic, dean, and in his words, a disruptive influence. Stephen, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the list of leaders and legends.
Nice to be here.
Great. Can we start with an overview of your career and publications?
Well, I've just never been able to keep a steady job. So I worked at the Open University in Wales, seconded up to Milton Keynes from 1972 to 85. Did lots of different things. I was a senior research fellow for 2 years, doing a huge longitudinal study of 30,000 adult learners. I then was appointed a senior counselor, but seconded into course teams. So I wrote part of a number of foundation courses and a number of other courses. Did a lot of television and radio. And then Margaret Thatcher came along and gave me a large check via some shenanigans at the OU. And I left Wales and went to Canada as Dean of the Business School at Athabasca University. And when I got there, Athabasca is like the Open University, a distance teaching university at that time. Very small business school, 900 students. And my brief was to get it to 5,000 students within 3 years. And we did. I went from 6 faculty to 25. I went from 900 students to actually 7,500. And we did it by reimagining what the work was and how we thought about learning and the learning experience. I then, in 93, 94, launched the world's first fully online MBA program, which was quite a ridiculous thing to do in 93, 94, when the internet was so slow and nobody ever heard of it. A focus group study by PricewaterhouseCoopers said, this will never succeed, so we did. And we were hugely successful. And then I'd left the university world in 1998 to become chief executive and chairman of the board of a group of companies in the UK, essentially in the field of management consulting. But I was also a visiting professor at Middlesex University, where I did a lot of work on launching new Masters in Leadership programs as a public-private partnership venture with companies like Marks and Spencers or social enterprise organizations like the Metropolitan Housing Trust. I returned to Athabasca University in 2003 as essentially Vice President External Relations, but also responsible for their entire branding strategy and marketing strategy. So I had experience of the commercial side of the business.
Yeah.
And I left in 2005, having realized I can't make much more difference here, to create my own enterprises. So I'm now running 6 separate companies, 2 of them not-for-profit, all focused on either helping to make a difference, or sharing knowledge and experience, or partnering with others to develop new capabilities and skills. So I'm trying to leverage quite a long career of understanding the learning experience into new experiences for young people or for people that now want to make a difference themselves. So that's my rough career history.
Great. So your very early work with the internet, way back in the early 90s, actually coming up toward mid-90s, those days would have been dial-up. Were there many technological frustrations that occurred?
Oh, yes. Well, here's the nice story. So the first assignment was due in 1994 for the first group of students. I was visiting an old friend in Hong Kong, and I said, do you mind if I use your phone to download these assignments from 24 students? And 4 days later, these assignments had downloaded, and it cost him around 200 thousand Hong Kong, whatever they were. Yeah. So he rang me later. He says, good job I'm a multimillionaire because I'm not doing this again. So that was one example. We just didn't understand what some of these dynamics were at the time.
Yeah.
The other thing about that too was we didn't have the program written when the students enrolled. So we were two courses ahead of the students in co-creating the materials with learners and students and academic peers around the world.
Yeah.
The other thing about the MBA, not just in terms of the technology, but we'd also unbundled the whole design process and structure of the organization process. So it was a radical transformation in other ways too.
Mm, mm. So a lot of your work, your publications deal with rethinking education.
Yes.
Is your work on the MBA the sort of work you've taken forward in publications?
Yes, I mean, I think I essentially describe myself now as a futurist, trying to imagine what learning and experiences will look like, not just in education, but in other sectors, 10 years from now, and then I come back to now and say, so what do we need to do differently now?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've got a project going with some colleagues around the world. We've met in Australia, in New Zealand, Chile, Paraguay, Ecuador, Europe, in partnership of researchers and teacher unions and teacher organizations to say, how do we defend public education?
Yeah.
But how do we reimagine it at the same time? We can't just defend the old ways of working. We have to reimagine new. And so I think most of my life is about saying, how do we lead disruption rather than be victims of it?
Mm, mm. So can you give us some insight then as to the ideas and themes your work has provided, especially those that you think are really pertinent today?
So I think one of the things that I really feel strongly about in online and distance learning is there's still a lot of practice which is rooted in the history of this work, which is going back to the early days of the OU, of big content packages, instructional-led design. And there was nothing wrong with it at the time. There was no alternative at the time. That's what we knew. But now, particularly with the emergence of new technologies like AI, augmented and virtual reality, we have to reimagine the design principles of the learning experience, starting from the learner, ending up with the learner, and then working out what assets and resources from around the world can we bring to bear on that learner's needs.
Yeah.
And so you take learners who are struggling. I have a grandson who's got a mild form of autism, and say, like, how can I make a difference to this young boy by using all the assets of the world, not just locally to me,
yeah,
to help this young man? And we found a number of things that are now making a difference to how he leads his life. And I think that's the job of all teachers, is to reimagine learning for that student or this group of students as something that's exciting and memorable and learning that you'll never forget. And unfortunately, a lot of learning right now is not defined in that way.
Mm, mm. So what you're talking about there is a highly personalised approach to education.
Yes.
Built into the educational design, or do you see AI potentially taking a role there?
Yes. I mean, I think all LMS systems have adaptive learning engines built into them, and some of them are pretty rudimentary. But they're getting better, and I think with a combination of really powerful smart analytics, AI that can now create resources, not just deliver them. So remember that things like the Washington Post published 2,000 articles in 2019 that were written entirely by AI. Mm. The BBC used AI to cover the recent election in the UK. And so I think we can have to reimagine learning all the time to make it intensely personal, and yet at the same time we can't lose this collective component. So I think if collaboration is the DNA of the knowledge economy, how do we design collaboration and peer networking and co-creation into everything we do? We can't isolate learners. We can't go down the route of what Gert Biesta calls learnification. We have to open up learning as a social experience.
Mm. Which is a complete, it's a fundamental difference to how education is offered today, usually around the expertise of a single instructor giving his or her knowledge out to students.
Yes, I think that model is unfortunately alive and well, but we need to get rid of it. And so one of the principles we had in thinking about the design work we're doing now is we have to co-create experiences with learners. We have to co-create the resources for learning with a network of people around the world. So, I have all sorts of expertise as an academic, but I'm not that stupid to think I'm really expert at anything. And I can find a network of people that can create much better resources between us than any one of us could create on our own. So, for example, right now I'm working on a certificate in strategic foresight for Athabasca University. And we have a small team working on that as volunteers around the world, including groups of young people in six countries helping to procure that resource.
Great. So it's now close to 2020. In fact, we're only about a week and a half away. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time? Where are we at as the 2010s come to a close?
So I have some privileged positions. I get to review course materials and resources from around the world. I get to be one of the reviewers for a major conference held every year, reading a couple of hundred abstracts every year. So I kind of look at the world and say, actually, there's not a lot going on, which is rather depressing. There's lots of pockets of innovation. And there's lots of pieces of puzzles that are really exciting. But as I keep saying to people, a lot of pockets don't make for a good suit. And what we need is a lot more imagination of how to bring these resources together. There's still a lot of courses that students have to experience that are badly designed. There's a lot of assessments that are very badly designed. And so I think we have a lot to learn from each other and a long way to go. But there are, as I say, don't write off some of the pockets of excellence, which we can now use to create new ways of thinking and working.
Mm. So all of these pockets of innovation, of course, do take place within an educational system. So to what extent is the system, in inverted commas, holding us back from actually making real progress here? I mean, do we need to see policy change? Do we need to see funding changes? What level of shift do you think is needed to unlock all of this?
Well, you take one of the areas of opportunity that we have is this whole modular stackable credentials kind of world. The corporations I partner with, which are mainly financial institutions or social enterprise organizations, are all seeking short-based learning activities that can be stacked into credentials and transferred into degrees eventually. And yet, most of our funding models, most of our policy frameworks inhibit that or don't allow that. More specifically, our quality assurance regimes are antiquated and pathetic by and large. And I've been responsible for designing some of these as well. I wrote some of the legislation for some of that in parts of Canada. So I think it's time to disrupt our quality assurance frameworks, to disrupt our thinking about design, and to disrupt our thinking about funding. And I'm looking to the transformation of the polytechnic sector in New Zealand as one opportunity to make a difference that the world should look at to how we think about all these things. The worry is that we'll just replicate what we've done historically, but in a larger organisation and make a mess. Mm. So New Zealand's on the edge of either doing something wonderful or a total disaster. Which is an exciting place to be, as long as we can all push it in the right direction.
Yeah. So could I just prompt you for some details in terms of a vision of what sort of push you'd like to give that New Zealand sector as a means of showing the world what might be possible?
So I think we should stop thinking about time as a basis for learning. So time-based funding, bums on seats over time, the Carnegie model of funding, needs to go. We should be funding a combination of innovation resources, base funding for sustainability, and outcomes. And trying to get that balance right is a policy nightmare, I get it. Mm. But we have to try, and we have to recognize that we keep getting it wrong, but we can correct it.
Yeah.
So looking for perfection is not a solution. So I think modular stackable learning, very strong public-private partnerships between public educational institutions and private players, as we were doing in Middlesex, is really a very powerful way to think about things. Lots of really good training and learning takes place inside organisations. We need to leverage it and recognise it and not pretend it's not quality. And I think another policy kind of decision is to think about flattening organisations and become more Uber-like. So just-in-time, 365 admission, those kind of thinking, I think are very key because as a learner, When I realise I need some learning, I want to do it now. I don't want to have to wait. And where did this semester stuff come from? I mean, it's some kind of fantasy of somebody that things always take either 8, 16 or 24 weeks. It's nonsense. So every learning activity has its own life. And we should identify this one takes 2 weeks, this one takes 4, this one takes 6, and stop thinking about credit equivalency and all this stuff. So let's blow up all that and start again.
So in that, I mean, just to probe still further, so there's possibly a difference between vocational and academic education, that the latter possibly involving more more reflection, more of a to be, more of an ontology sort of approach. Is that still compatible with the system you're describing, or are we carving up the vocational versus academic somewhat?
So I often think this is a kind of false dichotomy, but remember I've worked in professional academic schools.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I've never worked in a department of philosophy or a department of English or history. And so they may take a very different view. But from a professional learning point of view, in a business school or a medical school, we're all moving to competency-based learning. So the Canadian medical school system has adopted a competency-based learning framework, and they're now beginning to unbundle their course structure and permit a lot more prior learning assessment, a lot more activities that reflect the same way that vocational education goes. So, I mean, maybe it's not the academic vocational distinction, more as to the professional vocational distinction versus the purely academic. But again, how do we learn physics? How do we learn statistics? We learn it by module. So I don't think it's a necessarily different conversation, but it may be that all learning needs to be reflective, all learning needs to be co-creative.
Excellent. Stephen, if I was to give you an unlimited research budget, well, unlimited within reason, shall we say.
Yes.
An ambitious research budget. What would you apply it to? If you could choose any project, what would you undertake?
So right now, I'm really excited by what the potential of 5G brings to reimagining the learning experience, particularly for Indigenous learners, Maori, Pacifica, in Canadian context, First Nations learners. And they have a whole set of learning processes and values, a whole cultural way of thinking and way of learning that's different. And yet I think we could now begin to imagine leveraging immersion-like kind of learning in which we create elders, we create a whole virtual experience which replicates their ways of knowing. And so if I had an unlimited budget right now, I'd sit down in New Zealand with Maori and I'd sit down in Canada with the Blackfoot First Nation and say, how can we reimagine this learning given that we can now create any character, any persona, any kind of interaction you want, and do so in real time. And I think I'd co-fund the other half of the budget I'd need that from the one you're giving me with a telco that needs to demonstrate social value.
Yeah. And I think you've had an example of that, haven't you? I think
yes, we've been working with a First Nations group around thinking about this and have some demonstration projects beginning to run in parts of Canada which have 5G right now available. I mean, it's hugely expensive because it's very early stage. But this will all become very affordable 5 years from now. But 5 years is no time for reimagining a whole learning design, as you well know. So I think it's time to start that work now.
Yeah. So the vision then is a dialogic with actual virtual characters who represent an historical view of reality.
Right. I mean, Athabasca University is launching a virtual co-op this coming year, 2020, which does that kind of thing in a 4G space, using interaction with AI characters created in an online space. I'm imagining taking that a stage further and creating elders that are community elders that are widely recognised and respected in the Blackfoot community, and saying these are your mentors and peers, these are your coaches for this kind of learning. And we've done a little bit of work around that in understanding Indigenous ways of healing. But I think there's tons of things we can do with that.
It's a very unlimited futures there.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen, two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and someone else who you think might have an important perspective to share.
So one of the privileged projects I got to do was to do a retrospective impact analysis of the work of the Commonwealth of Learning over a decade. So not only did I get to travel the world, which was wonderful, but I got to meet some wonderful people. And so the two people that were responsible for the Commonwealth of Learning during that time were Sir John Daniel, former Vice Chancellor of the OU, also former Vice President of Athabasca University, and President of Laurentian University, sort of strong Canadian connections. And the other one is Professor Asher Kanwa, who's the current President and Chief Executive of the Commonwealth of Learning. So I think either of those would be one of my choices. And the other one who I think is doing some really imaginative leaping, I don't mean in a dancing sense, but leaping in terms of an intellectual sense of what learning has to become, is Dr. Neil Fassina, who's the current president of Athabasca University. Yeah. And they have released a learning framework which is incredibly radical. And what I see it doing is connecting all these pockets of innovation into one space. And I don't know anybody else who's doing that or attempting to do that at scale in the way that they are. So I'd say either Sir John Daniel or Professor Asher Kanwa and Neil Fassina. So I get three.
You've given me an unfair choice to start with. I think I might just go for three.
Yeah.
Stephen, it's been great meeting you and a real pleasure to talk with you this morning.
Good to be here.
And welcome to the halls of Leaders and Legends of Online Learning.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You can learn more about Stephen and his work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.